session number 17629, Mr. David Ridley, Reel 18.
Mr. Ridley, Reel 18. We were talking about your Territorial Army days. What happened to you when you came out of the Territorial Army?
When I came out of the what?
When you left the 8th Battalion.
Oh, well, just before I leave the 8th Battalion, I'll give you a couple of funny things that happened with it. This is just to bring out the point that Army rules and regulations are laid down as a guide. They're not as, you know, you've got to carry them out 100%. And a funny thing happened. We were at Otterburn Camp for our fortnight's train, annual train. And this particular fella, Tony Bainbridge, who was a DCM, by the way, he was involved in this particular incident. Now, when the bugle call goes for fire drill, well, at Animal Camp, you always had a fire drill. And the routine is that you stop what you were doing, put your steel helmet on, grab a fire bucket and pray it on the square. That is more or less the basic rules. Unfortunately, when we were at Otterburn, it was a tented camp. Eh? So, anyway, the bugle went, the fire call went this particular day, and we thought, well, most people thought it was a practice again, so some put a steel helmet on, buckets, and Tony Bainbridge, who was the sergeant major at the time, was standing on the square, chasing people back. Get away back! Go and get your steel helmets on! When in actual fact, it was Tony's tent that was a fire. So he was chasing the fire brigade, and his tent went up in smoke.
He'd got his DCM escaping from the Polish prison camp and ultimately getting into Russia.
There was a funny incident that happened with me. I was on parade. I always used to get the job of escorting the colours in the 8th Battalion. I don't know why, but I always, and I used to love it. Anyway, I was standing outside Brunswick Castle, and Princess Alexandra was company inspectors. Well, when she came down the line to the colours, she spoke to the ensigns, and then she said to me, "Where have you escaped from?" And I looked at her with amazement. I said, "Well, I'm sorry, ma'am." I said, "I never escaped from anywhere. I was never taken prisoner." Now, I got to know later on that Tony Bainbridge was the right marker. So, Natchi, she was the first one she spoke to. And she asked him where he got the DCM, and he escaped into Russia, actually. And he must have said, well, the chap that was with me was Roberts. He was a corporal at the time. He says, "You'll find him farther down the line." Well, the next DCM she met was me. She assumed that I'd escaped with Tony Bainbridge. We had another character, another sergeant major, actually, a lad called George Ball. And I'll put this in because I think it was funny. George, finally, during the war, he joined the paratroops. Eh? And he was a sergeant major in the paratroops. And he must have been a bit of a boy, like, he must have been a bit of a disciplinarian, like, because it was noted that the chaps used to say, "Well, don't worry, we'll get you for this," you know. Which they don't do openly, but they do get the grapevine coming around and saying, "You want to watch yourself." So, he used to say, well, I don't know the correct procedure, but it's something like this. He used to say to himself, "Well, you'll never get me," he said, "because at night time, I jump first." And he says, "I'll be down there waiting for you coming down." He says, "In daytime," he says, "I jump last." He says, "We're going to watch all of you going down." Eh? This is the sort of thing. So anyway, he was in India, by the way. This is where this happened. Now, the camps in India were always encircled with about a 15-foot barbed wire, dunnet fence, they keep out the thugs. Anyway, he was going to get released. And the chaps used to say, well, these companies said, well, come to the canteen, you know, have a few drinks with the zero before you go home. So he went and he had a few drinks with the lake. And after everybody got half cut, I imagine, they put him up on his shoulder, you know, and were dancing him around the compound shouting, he's a jolly good fellow. We're all singing it, he's a jolly good fellow. And he's a jolly good fellow, right up to the perimeter fence, and they go, pfft, and they flew right into the centre of this blooming barbed wire. He says, so they did get the horn back in a sense. He was a nice chap, like, he lived at Craighead, actually. I'm not sure whether he's alive or not these days.
What was the background of the men that were in the territorials after the war? So similar to what there had been before the war?
Yes, more or less, yes.
Mines
They're
and
all
stuff.
Miners. And then, I think young men in those days fancied the army, in a sense. They thought it was, you know, something to be proud of, something to... instead of having just a home life all the time, they had another hobby, apart from being, you know, playing football and things like that, because golf in those days wasn't very popular in this area. It is now, like, but...
When did you get involved with the cadets?
Well, I had this last escapade with the 8th Battalion. I was sent for by Colonel Sharland. It happened that it was a big weekend, you know, at Captic. And, I mean, in a TU, you volunteer, and you just volunteer to go on the weekend. You got paid for it, by all means. But I wasn't on this particular weekend, but something had happened, and Colonel Sharon wasn't very happy about it. I think the exercise was, you know, kaput, sort of. So, whether he sent for all sergeant majors or not, I don't know. But I got word through the grapevine that I was going to get sent for and get, you know, told off for this poor weekend. So I did my summons and I went in front of him and he gave me a right blowing telling off. And you see, at that particular time, I'd started the sergeant's message, as you see, which I was entitled to do. And everybody used to come there. It used to go, I made thousands of pounds for the battalion at his sergeant's message, as you see. And everybody at Durham was blooming jealous of it. And this was one of the reasons. I think it was the RSM that started to put the boot in. Anyway, I says, well, I'm sorry, sir. I says, if you feel like that, but I says, if I would like to, you know, consult me notes. I says, I had at least 40 men on that weekend, which was twice as many as any other company. I says, I had 3 sons on there. I says, the only 2 sons that weren't there, I says, they had bereavements. I says, they couldn't go. I says, I was the only one who was off. And I says, you turn around and you make a remark, it was a bloody sergeant's message. Jesse said, caused all this. I says, it wasn't the sergeant's message, Jesse said. I was the only one in the sergeant's message, Jesse said. I says, so. And I says, I'm not very happy at all with this. And I says, I would like to come down to Colour Sergeant. He says, when he thought a bit like, and he says, you can't come down to Colour Sergeant, you can come down to Sergeant if you want to. So I came out there with the intention of coming down to Sergeant. And when I told all my sergeants, I says, you're a bloody fool, Dave. All the work that you've done here. So I says, right, that's it. And I just resigned. From then, Colonel Robertson had left the 8th Battalion and he'd taken over the Army Cadet Force. And I often used to meet him, even when I was in the TA at Chester Street. And he says, well, why don't you come into the Army Cadet Force with me? So I joined the Army Cadet Force, and I was made County RSM of the Army Cadet Force. And I stopped with them 12 years.
Were they good 12 years?
Yes, very good. It was rather a bit tedious coming out of the Army, because most of they called them instructors, but they were nearly all officers, you know, they carried an officer's rank, and yet I hadn't a blooming clue about military. In fact, if I had a battalion parade, I used to have to get a hold of some of these officers by the hand and lead them and put them where they're supposed to go. I used to give them lectures, but it didn't seem to be absorbed. Anyway, they were quite nice fellas, mate. I mean, they looked after the boys and they trained them in the various crafts. At that particular time, it was only to teach a young man to be a better citizen. And then they changed the code that teach the young men to be a better citizen and hope that he may join the British Army, which a lot of them did. But then again, the government, I mean, they could have had an army reserve of thousands of young men, but they didn't put the blooming money in. I mean, they wouldn't even give them uniforms. The uniforms they wear was all denims and, you know, anything they could scrounge. You couldn't even give them a rifle each, which every, you know, child used to do. Oh, I've got a rifle, and you go on parade with it, and you go on doing exercise. You didn't even have enough rifles to give them. And then there's this business about regimental silver. I mean, we've got stacks and stacks of silver scattered all over the blooming country, really, which shouldn't be, in my opinion. It should be in a museum. But these Army Cadet Force, they formed a band, and they couldn't even get a silver bugle. They were blown on all brass bugles and God knows what else. And I reckon if the government had put in a bit more money to help these kids, it would have been, they had no problem with blooming recruits. The Army Cadet Force is still gone. And they're the only people that's carrying the DLI tradition too. They wear the DLI cap badges, they do the DLI drill. And I'm afraid in 100 years' time, the DLI will just fade away if somebody didn't do something about it.